you could say at the outset is that looking at the clock and subject always to my friend's amount of examination, we should well finish it.
Yes, well, we're trying to make sure that Commissioner Mayden will be able to get home to Christchurch.
So as a please the court, as with other counsel, I'm not going to read my very long submissions. I'm going to highlight a number of matters.
Yes.
And have a good discussion with yourselves on the key things that still lie in the points I want to emphasise, starting with Emu Hauraki, that you heard during the hearing, as I set out in my footnote one, just to acknowledge the faces and voices of our whanaunga, pako, Ngāi Tai Ki Tāmaki, Ngāti Hei, Ngāti Maru, Ngāti Pau, Ngāti Tauraki Hauraki, Ngāti Kuchiki Ki Hauraki, Ngāti Rāhiri Tūratū, Ngāti Tamatara, Ngāti Taratokumiri, Ngāti Whanaunga, Ngāti Pachakiri Kiri Kira Tāpa. I set out a reference to evidence of Mrs. Taipari and McIntyre and appreciate the indulgence of the court in excusing them from today. I won't be going through their evidence. What I do want to note, again, back at the footnotes, just on the mapping, as my friend Mr. Ferguson touched on, it's been helpful for the council to provide the maps you've received in relation to Emu Hauraki. You see those prospective areas of interest, etc., overlaying the PC1 area. And those are helpful one by one for the 12. And as the council knows, they've been sourced from either just reflecting also on the first week when Judge Williams was inquiring about mapping for Emu Hauraki, we also had Mr. McIntyre's evidence that you may have seen various Hauraki collected redress maps showing an overlay with the PC1 room. As the court's well aware, context is everything, as I'm off to say, and importantly, in the context for Emu Hauraki and what they're seeking, our history, our whakapapa, is so important in terms of why we seek what we seek. And as Your Honour noted, and the court has noted, our respective iwi, as across the mutu, fiercely independent and jealously guard their mana mutuhaki. In fact, as Judge William Wells knows, within the collective tables, it's not a small achievement to keep those tables together because of that autonomy in mana mutuhaki. But the story, the history of iwi of Hauraki is its one, and each tribe has their history. So in paragraph 2, and I'm going to read this because it is so important and underlays everything that has been sought and put before the court. This is from the Tribunal of Hauraki report from 2006. The evidence relating to Māori health and housing from the late 19th century until after 1945 shows that Hauraki Māori were among the most disadvantaged and needy people in New Zealand. Consideration of these matters is connected to the fact that Hauraki Māori had lost more of the customary land than most iwi. We conclude that Hauraki Māori had been marginalised in their own rohe by the transfer of land and resources to others, including Māori of other iwi. Moreover, we find that this outcome, particularly the wholesale purchasing of Hauraki lands, was the consequence of policies and laws deliberately introduced and sustained well into the 20th century, and that this falls short of the treaty requirement that land and other taonga be acquired through informed consent. In this context, we note particularly that the Crown has conceded that Hauraki iwi lost large areas of land during the Raupatu of the 1860s and have received very little compensation either in land or money. In these matters and other matters discussed in our report, we find that the treaty principle of dealing fairly and with utmost good faith have been breached, that substantial restitution is due, and that the quantum should be settled by prompt negotiation. That was 2006 and we still haven't settled. So that provides a very real context in terms of the paucity of land holdings that our people have and the impact of PC1, especially on treaty settlement redress to come. The next point I want to note, as hopefully has become apparent to the court, is that the most recent version of the proposed relief is attached to these submissions, and that draws on, like other parties, the conduct and we met as a top teacher with him, and I'll go through some of those meetings. And you may have seen in paragraph 6, for the reasons it's set out there, obviously for the court's own decision, but seeking that, it may be helpful to have an interim decision in terms of the very important conclusions and findings that are coming. But in terms of settling the final form of objectives and policies, etc., that would give the parties an opportunity to get some comment in line with the court's findings and conclusions. But obviously that's a matter for the court to decide. In paragraph 7, I echo my friend Mr. Ferguson's note that there is no issue between the UE in terms of customary interests. Moving down to, please let me know if you want to talk about any reasons to go along. I'm going to move down to the legal framework, noting there over on page 4 that there's been a constant canvassing by the parties, and I'm not going to repeat that, and obviously to stress the importance of Article 15. At 15, it appears common ground that the final form of PC1 is studied in Part 2, especially Sections 16, 7A and 8. And that was agreed to by Mr. Trebilco in the first week, as you may recall. Thus, we say no Davidson or King Salmon issues arise. And important to note that the High Law, as I call it, of Maguire, it is as always apt in this case. As we've been seeing through to this afternoon, one of the themes of counsel's evidence examination was that key implementation machinery is yet to be formulated. That's not a criticism, and that's just where things are at. For example, the regimes for offset compensation and contaminant allocation. And quite where the line beyond which laudable intentions to come to RMA adequacy is live. And again, that's point for the court to assess and make its decision. It brings me to the relief itself. Many of these things remain the same as per our evidence, especially that Mr. Turner. So, again, subject to questions the court may have on specific matters, I'm going to highlight a few of those key things. Policy 5 and Policy 18 has attracted much attention, unsurprisingly, and including this afternoon. So at 24, the guidance of the court in its 2 November minute is helpful. And with the proposed wording reflecting, that's proposed wording of UE Hodak reflecting the substance of the amendment. So our wording's been updated on that basis. We note the policy 18 proviso 5 is located at the commencement of the policy 5, actually it's 5 included. Policy 18 proviso located at the commencement of the policy 5 preamble is to ensure its proper operation, and I took that to be the essence of what Mr. Brock was saying as well, in terms of its location. We say the proviso is ticket. It would be a truly perverse outcome for treating settlement regions land utilisation to suffer attacks due to the intergeneration of public from others. I wanted to pause here and pick up an important discussion, and this has played out over the weeks. I think, can I say, sir, it's been really helpful to have the transcripts from the FAR, but they have been very effective. Perhaps not a literally high point such as Alistair Cook's letters from America, but it's been very, very useful. Coming back to the important point,
we'll try it.
Coming back to the important point that Judge Williams articulated in respect to the early discussions, however it's best phrased, tensions or the intersection of the important aspiration of restoration on the one hand, but also equity and the importance for money offender as recognised in Part 2. And it could take us in different places. One comparison comes to mind with the whole matter of climate change and carbon reduction commitments by countries. And as we're aware, there's much work and analysis on the position of developing countries in terms of the equity of those positions coming onto them, when it's been the developed nations that have, as it said, put us in this position. So there are echoes of that dynamic in what we're facing here. And so it's a very important but also hard issue to deal with in terms of where the right line is drawn. And that also brings into a focus as to whether there's a tension between the 2-5 Munga, Part 2, Section 6A, 6A, 7A, and 8. And it could be said in one sense there is, but also as the senior courts have emphasised, trying to reconcile those provisions, those interests, those outcomes is very important. I just want to draw as a reminder to Sir, your glorious victory in King Salmon in terms of some of the discussion that occurred then. And much of that that paradigm was in place in that case there with the NZCPS, obviously. And Supreme Court articulated in some of the arguments, and this is at 86B, Court said the danger of such an approach is that Part 2 may be seen as trumping the NZCPS rather than the NZCPS being the mechanism by which Part 2 is given effect in relation to the coastal environment. So trying to weave together those elements rather than saying they're in tension or opposition. And so it's entirely achievable to do that in this case in terms of the restoration objectives as well as recognising through reflecting those Part 2 provisions and especially for the principle of the treaty that equity position for Mount Whenua. Just one other important extract from King Salmon where the court was discussing how give effect to operate, and this is at 88, and midway through that paragraph the court says, which I'll just start at the beginning to give the context. So before addressing this submission, we should identify three caveats to the end principle answer we have just given. And second, the well-known one, there may be instances where the NZCPS does not cover the field and a decision-maker will have to consider whether Part 2 provides assistance in dealing with the matters not covered. The key point I want to emphasise is the next sentence. Moreover, the obligation in Section 8 to have regard to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi will have procedural as well as substantive implications, which decision-makers must always have in mind, including when giving effect to the NZCPS. So that sentence very much plays in this case as well. We substitute the 35 mana for NZCPS and Section 8 as is right here.
That was a very, I assume when you talk about equity too, though, it's not simply the ability to economically utilise land which you may or may not receive by way of treaty still. It's equity in terms of involvement in decision making, it's equity involved in terms of being advised of or being involved in that process. There's a whole range of things. But currently we're focusing on the ability to utilise
land. That's exactly right, and it's a good reminder of the wider context because, leaving aside, debates in other areas around the place of co-governance, as we've seen, we have real co-governance going on here. We're yet to reach that point, but for the river iwi in terms of their sediments, that has been in part delivered. And here's another aspect of that bundle, if you like, of how equity plays out.
Well, I mean, Mr. McIntyre was explaining about the fact that the real production hadn't been involved in the process, so I assume that's part of the equity level.
It is too. And in that vein, it's important, as we acknowledge in paragraph 27, that the acknowledgement by Federated Farmers and Beef and Land of the need for PC1 to be enduring, equitable and effective demonstrates, and I should say, real leadership. And again, it's important to articulate that leadership. So that was a paragraph, this is the Council's notes, paragraph 2.1f. As part of that enduring, equitable and effective community-wide solution, there needs to be an ability for iwi to utilise land returned to them or purchased by them as a result of treaty settlements. To allow that to occur while still achieving the 25 mana, headroom will need to be created. That headroom will need to come from existing pastoral land users and from the source discharges. It's a very brave statement and one to be acknowledged. Paragraph 28, I note in our draft and policy 18 itself is as per the agreed expert conferencing version. Since then we've had today Mr. Gruff's updated version of policy 18, and I can say in effect that we've note in terms of my 29 policy 7 consent terms, I made reference to Mr. Tripoko's examination in terms of the place of generally in that policy, and as I note there, he also considered it wouldn't be a backward step for the non-consent terms of factual reason. We say the proposal of the ancestral lands exception is a ticket. Note that in one of the few instances, we're not quite on all fours as between the River Elf, there's the River Iwi in terms of the Friends, submissions, and Iwi of Hauraki. That'll be for the court to make its decision on. Again, it's not saying that it's a guarantee or a must have, it's an ability to at least clear your case in terms of where the merits lie. So I can understand where my friend and the River Iwi are coming from. Hopefully, the court understands where the Iwi are coming from for the reasons that I emphasised at the end. The big ticket item, as we know, is the activity status. And I've set out there both the reasoning that Mr. Kabulko gave, our responses to that. I don't know that I need to go through that. Thankfully, the arguments are well known. At the risk of my very unlikely comedic career, I was struck by the images. I think Judge Williams was talking about images in terms of gateways and the like. And the image that came to mind for me was, in terms of how this plays out, at the 100-metre hurdles line, you've got the likes of Carl Lewis and his finery of the deer scare. Behind him, there's some gates where yourself and his swanny stubbies and jandals is trying to push his way through the gate to get to that line, but it's just unachievable. So, agricultural, I know, but it tries to make the point. As between the options of discretionary and restrictive discretionary, again, we're not quite on that item with River Iwi, and I would make the point here, again, for the reasons that Iwi of Hauraki make in terms of the opportunity to make its case, we don't see a little difference that can go against us or for us, in a sense, so there's no problem, why not go with discretionary. But again, in terms of having the ability and make the best case, as long as the reserve matters are fulsome, and we say they are, we say there's nothing left out or unknown, then there's no risk. Again, there's no guarantees for the outcomes, and we don't have these artificial barriers of being able to make our case. The last point I want to emphasise in these submissions is the definition of Tangatina ancestral land. I made the foolhardy submission of 37 that it appears no issue remains with the inclusion of Tangatina land. not quite there. But listening to the friend Mr. Ferguson, as for the reasons why, and those are probably understood in terms of the Manapinga link, acknowledging also that that would apply to Māori freehold land as well. Yes, there's a different regime to be put on Māori land, but Māori freehold land is capable of alienation as well, and that could go to Ngāti ABC from the South Island. So at that point, it already exists for the current definition, but it's a point well made. And so, at the risk of drafting on the hoof, we turn to the definition of some of the ancestral lands. And in the third line, where it refers to Māori freehold land and general land, and I'm sure there are better ways to express this, after the word general land, the words could be inserted of Manapinga. So it would read, Māori freehold land and general land of Manapinga under jurisdiction of the Te Whenua Māori, 1993. So that may bring us back to the other parts. We'll see in the two of those are the matters I want to emphasise, and of course, happy to answer any questions.
No, very clear. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. thank you, sir. Actually, having said that, seeing Commissioner Hodges and thinking we might ask some questions, just picking up on that last discussion with Mr. Brough, and I can certainly understand trying to navigate the way through here in a way that works. I'm sure it's not intended, but one thing that struck me from a potential regime, and I'll without a poor paraphrase here, to have a regime that says, and excuse me if I got this wrong, that has as a requirement the inability to apply until reductions have been made to a certain level, would be pretty onerous very challenging. As I say, my apologies if I've mischaracterised where that thinking was going, but it was probably important to say something about that.
Well, look, I appreciate the fact that you have done that. I guess what I was really trying to come from is the point that the key achievement is to not get any worse and have a reduction. And so that was the driver there. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of variations on that theme, and someone's going to have to do some innovative thinking to get this right, and I was just trying to start the process. I'm sure it started long ago, because it's quite difficult coming in at this late stage and not realising all the debates that are going on.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for that comment.
Happy to call Mr. Turner, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Mike, thank you.
Do
you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the grand affirmative,
evidence of
lots of the truth,
shall
the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Sure, Mr. Turner, your name is Richard Jonathan Turner?
Yes.
I'm the director of Mitchell Dash Limited?
Yes.
You produced two statements, your primary of 28 July this year and your rebuttal of 11 August this year?
That's correct.
You participated in expert conferencing?
Yes.
You confirm that the results of their comments are accurate?
Yes.
Please answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right.
Thanks, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Good. Could I get you to turn to your rebuttal evidence at paragraph 14? Flips over two pages. The second, you talk here about non-compliant activity status, and on the second page, you talk about the practical effect of that rule. So, the practical effect of Rule 9 is the incentification for using the balance of concessional land cannot actually navigate the gateway test for non-compliant activities, then PC1 will not have recognised and provided for the matters in Section 6 of the Act. And I'm just trying to understand the converse of that position. In the context of the rest of the objectives and policies of PC1, do you agree that the inclusion of a tangata whenua ancestral lands specific objective and policy are capable of creating a pathway for land use change on that land to pass through the 104D gateway test?
Subject to the drafting, yes.
Yes. We can move down to paragraph 24. There you talk about objective 4C, and you say, consider the focus of objective 4C should continue to be on minimising unnecessary impediments to the use and development of ancestral land. And I'm thinking about that word unnecessary. Do you agree that in order to achieve the water quality objectives of PC1 and 35 Mana, there need to be limits on land use change in the PC1 catchment?
Yes.
And are objectives 1 and 2 relevant to the question of whether impediments are necessary?
I think they are. I think the point that I was making there is that other evidence was around how the relationship with objective forwards focused on limiting impediments to the use of development was around in a resource consent process, where, in my view, it also goes to the architecture of the provisions that rely on objective forwards as well.
Yes, and so there's a balance to be struck there between enabling on one hand and protecting on the other, and that's why I anticipate you've used the word unnecessary here rather than saying simply minimising impediments, because some impediments might be necessary. Impediments might be a tricky word to use perhaps, but in practical effect there are some steps and tests to go through in order to assess whether land use change in any given situation is appropriate, and therefore some impediments of some kind will be necessary. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think upon reflection, it's probably the better word is around restrictions.
Yes, okay, that's fine. Now, I wonder if you could turn, you got a copy of the EU Hauraki legal submissions with you and the provisions attached to those?
I do.
And were you involved in drafting those provision amendments for the updates to them?
Yes.
Can I get you to turn to the definition of Tangata Whenua ancestral land? As it's written there. I'm conscious Mr. Majuri talked through one possible amendment to that today, but I just wanted to get a sense from you about your understanding of the meaning of the words under the jurisdiction of the Tūri Whenua Māori Act. What's your understanding about what land is under that jurisdiction?
My understanding is that if the land by which effectively the Māori Land Court has the ability to make decisions around property construction,
I see. So it's those particular types of powers you've got in mind rather than necessarily status change? It might be going beyond what you're familiar with, that's fine.
Yeah.
I just want to check your understanding. Because if it was the case, and again, this is obviously subject to those who are more expert than I in this, but if it was the case that all land in New Zealand was able to have its status determined or changed under the Tūri Whenua Māori Act, then, and if that took it under the jurisdiction of the Act, or if it was at least capable of being read that way, would that align with the way you see this definition working?
Yes, certainly that wasn't my expectation, but it's probably started to get outside the scope of my understanding of that discussion of that legislation.
Yes, for sure.
I was struggling to understand it too, so it's the comment. The essence of your question, that is, we land in New Zealand is defined within.
It could be brought under.
It could be brought under, yes. So, in terms of section 129 of the Act, where all land in New Zealand has one of the listed statuses, and then the following sections in part 6 indicate the ability of the Māori Land Court to determine the status or change the status of that land. And so, I was wanting to ascertain whether the witness understood that status component to be part of the jurisdiction of the Act and therefore the definition in terms of its breadth. Thank you. So, Mr. Turner, you have in mind a narrower application of this definition than, to put it in simple terms, all land in New Zealand. Obviously, you're trying to narrow it down to some extent.
It's not my expectation that this definition would apply to all land in New Zealand.
So to implement your expectation and your use of this, if that was the way it was to be read on its face here, that would need to be narrowed down in order to implement what you were trying to achieve with it.
I think this question around is the word jurisdiction appropriate. I don't think any alternative wording that would be appropriate at this warrant narrowing the definitions to it at this point. It's not my understanding that, it's the whole land would be sort of the only jurisdiction.
Great, thank you. And that's, I think that's helpful at this point, because like some of the other changes that have been put forward here, we'll be doing some more consideration of those, and I just want to make sure as we do that, we understood what you were intending. Thank you very much for making this turn. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Mr.
Thompson or Mr. Anderson?
I want to firstly take you to the amended provisions attached to your Labour Council's submission.
Yes.
And if we look at policy 5 here, it still refers to it being where any contaminant increases in lot of a contaminant that Table 311.2 identifies as a priority for a reduction in that subcatchment. Are you aware that that table is now being agreed to be deleted?
Agreed through?
Well, that the council has withdrawn it because it had some deficiency.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Right. Now, I want to ask you a question about policy 11 of the National Policy Statement, Freshwater Management, which talks about all existing over allocation being phased out. So, is your position that this doesn't cover the field and we need to go up to Part 2, Section 60, 7 and 8?
That policy amendment doesn't cover the field.
Does the NPSFM as a whole cover the field?
As it relates to what, sorry?
The matter that we're considering here, which is a discretionary activity role for Tangata Whenua Convention.
It's my understanding that Tangata 1 does accept a legal effect to the NPSFM in 2020. So, while it has overlaps with components of what the EBS requires, there are other elements, as it's done now, as it's done in Part 2, that could continue to apply and require consideration. So I don't think we're in a situation whereby the NPS fresh water is the start and finish of that consideration.
Okay, so you're not of the view that the PC1 has to give effect to the policies in Part 2 of the NPSFM?
It's my understanding that PC1 is starting down the track of giving effect to PC1, but that there will be subsequent plan changes that sort of fill in the gaps, I suppose, of the other elements that the NPS need to address. So, it's my understanding, I see the PC1 as being fully giving effect to the NPS, I suppose.
No, it's not, but my proposition is that it has to give effect to these policies.
All of them?
Put the policies under 2.2 policies. Part 3 of the NPSFM has procedural steps, sometimes referred to as the NOF, etc. But I've put forward in legal submissions that these policies have to be given effect to even now.
Well, if that's, I suppose, my initial reaction to that sort of question, if that is the case, there's significant elements of those policies in 2.2 that aren't you're asking me to ask basically one that there's all those answers to that 2.2 million years. My answer would be no topic.
All right. And just finally, so policy 11, if we look at that, generally from a planning perspective, you would agree, wouldn't you, that the word avoid is directive? And generally from a planning perspective, you would use a non-compliant activity status if something is to be avoided?
I don't think there's a direct relationship necessarily. When you're determining activity status, there needs to be a consideration of all the relevant policies, not just one. Appreciating there's a policy around avoiding animal eradication, there may well be other provisions which are required consideration. So I don't think there is necessarily a direct line of sight between policy that says avoid in a non-compliant activity group necessarily, because there will be a need to consider the range of policies that come into play. So you may well be in a situation whereby it is appropriate for them to be discretionary activity because of the need to, as part of the risk of consent application, to consider policies around the void versus other policies in the sector to potentially facilitate other outcomes.
Yeah, and it would also depend, wouldn't it, on evidential matters, such as whether we can be certain that with another activity status over allocation will still be avoided. If I'm again looking at this policy specifically, but evidential matters do come into it as well, don't they?
Could you repeat that question?
So if we're specifically looking at this particular policy, and I know you've said that we have to look across the planning documents, but say we are focusing on this policy, regardless of the activity status, we also have to look at the evidence to see whether, say, a discretionary activity still gives us certainty that over-allocation would still be avoided under a discretionary activity. In part, it's an evidential issue.
But I suppose where I'm struggling with the question is that it seems like you're trying to get line of sight between policy 11 and rule 9, the non-compliant activity rule. And my view would be that the non-compliant activity rule as applies to some penalty system length, for example, requires consideration on objectives 1 and 2, and particularly 4. So the question seems to be that you're sort of suggesting we skip over those objectives and we go from policy 11 to rule 9. So that's where I'm struggling.
Alright, I think I'll just leave it there. Thank you, Mr. Turner. That's fine. Thank you.
Ms. Ford?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Toops?
I thank you for your evidence, Mr. Turner, for the helpful clarification of various of these matters. I just wanted to touch on some of the challenging issues we've got that I see are reflected in some of the commentary in your brief of evidence, and I certainly understand some of the suggestions and what sits behind them in terms of additional statements in the preambular background aspects of chapter 311, and also I think some suggestions to amendments of other parts of the plan, in parts 2 for example. From a planning perspective, are those other parts within the scope for plan change of chapter 311?
from my understanding, in terms of the chapter itself, parts of the plan. So I believe it's a
Would you accept as a general principle that if we're going to introduce statements, or I suppose value statements, in relation to any of the iwi of the of interest in the river, whether that's the five of the iwi that I represent or the iwi of Hauraki, all of which clearly have interest in different parts of the catchment, and some of those interests are overlapping, you acknowledge and understand that, don't you?
Yes.
And at the moment, Chapter 311, apart from referring to values of Tangata Whenua, doesn't specify those values or provide any descriptions for any iwi in that regard, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No. And I suppose if we are going to start including those matters, then the appropriate way to do that would be to ensure that each of the iwi with those interests are able to articulate those values so that they essentially sit in an equitable setting. Would that be a fair approach from your experience in terms of the way in which those things are dealt with in plans?
Yeah, I don't know if it's fair. I think just to reinforce that, the key point I was trying to get across there was that the intent was set to ensure that those values are integrated.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a leaves it a situation where for council staff or applicants, it's trying to provide a greater degree of transparency around what others are actually talking about, so that there's some degree of understanding of what we're aiming at.
And this is a much bigger issue, isn't it? Because when I scan more generally across the rest of the regional plan and also the current Waikato regional policy statement, there are enormous gaps, and there's clearly not only for Hauraki but for a number of other iwi, including Te Wharetoa, Ngāti Hauā, Ngāti Kōrohi, Kahukura, etc. The drafting of the chapters dealing with the recognition of those groups and their values and interests are clearly many years out of date. That would be a fair observation.
Yes, and in preparing my evidence, I was looking quite particularly at chapter 2 and the acknowledgement of it wasn't some values in that instance. I think it was sort of there might have been their issues of
concerns, I think.
Yeah, and my sort of observation of them was that they were. This is a lot of relevant matters, but I must suggest that they are sort of outdated in terms of where some of these issues around water and the use of ancestral land, etc., where they now sit.
So, from your view, having read those and while appreciating the rationale for suggesting some changes here, would be that chapter requires an overhaul and an update for the benefit of all iwi with interest within the Waikato region.
Irrespective of this process.
And in fact, I think in the regional policy statement, there's a whole chapter that just has a square bracket that says still to be completed. There's no recommend.
I've
No, thank you. And do you think that, appreciating the other matters that we are trying to grapple with of substance here, while acknowledging the issues you've raised in that regard, that with the pending further plan change in relation to the implementation of the MPS FM 2020, which obviously is highly loaded towards the recognition and articulation of Tangata Whenua and Mana Whenua values, that would provide a very good opportunity to start afresh and include as part of that process the identification and articulation of the values of the iwi o Hauraki and other iwi with interest in the Waikato region and bring those forward as part of that plan change in a comprehensive and fully informed way?
I don't think it precludes the natural correlation that's been suggested in this instance. We've still got that situation where we've got an objective that talks about integrating values and in the context of this plan change. includes appropriate amendments in this instance.
And look, I certainly am not trying to belittle or poo-poo the good planning sense or even necessarily critique the articulation, but what you have proposed is a generic statement of interests, relationships and values for all mana whenua effectively in the Waikato and Waipa rivers, haven't you?
Yeah, my primary evidence.
You started with an area of Hauraki version, yes. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was going to say, in my evidence, I did also acknowledge that there would be, there would essentially be providing and relief that's, well, the appropriate for other entities also to articulate their views as well. So, I did make that point in my primary evidence.
But if we're going to talk about including collective language, about mana whenua generically, would be important, obviously, for that to be a consensus position between those mana whenua for it to be included within the plan. Separate, different if you're talking simply about one iwi in their perspective. Would you agree there's a difference in that respect?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you for your evidence. I just wanted to clarify that. The point in principle is well understood and appreciated, and I'm trying to find the best way of progressing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Working backwards, Mr. Turner, on that last exchange, you acknowledge understanding the sentiment, and I think we all do. You also pointed out the risk of an objective that refers to values and those being absent, and so therefore I took from that there is that gap. You recall the notified version of Piece of One?
Yes.
You recall that that included iwi values? So there's one option that tries to balance, if that's the right word, those matters, the sentiment, as well as the lacuna, the gap, is to include the values from the notified version, remembering as the council holds that are written by the people. In relation to the discussion on giving effect to, in planning practice, as you understand it, do you give effect to the individual single policy or the whole NPS?
The whole NPS.
You agreed with Mr. Conway that potentially, theoretically, objectives could be drafted to allow a gateway in an NC activity rule, and you see it subject to the drafting. Just to be clear, does that drafting currently exist in PC1?
That provides the gateway?
Yes.
And in the decision version?
Yes.
No.
For the reasons that you understand as to why iwi of Hauraki seek to restrict a discretionary and river iwi CNI, it seems the right word, a discretionary activity. You see any real, from a planning point of view, utility in trying to shoehorn into a non-compliant activity, something that might work, might, versus an RD or D rule?
Sorry, could you repeat that one?
Where do you think the emphasis should be, trying to shoehorn an objective regime that allows a gateway, or concentrating on what a restricted discretionary activity might provide?
The latter.
Thank you. Yes.
Just one thing, yes, Mr. Turner, and I'm going back to the question that Mr. Conway was putting to you around the definition of mana whenua essential alone. He was asking about general land under the jurisdiction of the Tiriti Whenua Māori. You probably won't know that there's a list of types of lands which are the statuses of land which are identified in the Tiriti Whenua Māori Act.
6.9.
Yes. But you do know that?
Yes.
Okay. And of course, they're just general land, but that of itself, the fact that it's listing doesn't put it within the jurisdiction of the Māori Language Board, to do the Māori. Are you aware of that?
Yes. Yeah.
Right, because there's a particular definition of general land held by Māori.
Yes.
And that is within the jurisdiction, so you're aware of that. And that's what you intend. And in terms of the definition, I'm just trying to clarify.
Yeah, and it is. And I noticed landowner jurisdiction of the Act, that
yeah.
Albert Thunder Penal would be another way, for example, to potentially deal with that issue.
Okay, all right. I think I leave it. Thank you.
Arising out of that issue of the commission. Thank you very much for your influence. That's the case then for you, the Hire. Thank you. That brings the hearing of the evidence to a conclusion. We're going to adjourn now to the hearing date on the 5th of December in Auckland. I'm going to do a bit more work on the site visit memorandum and consult with the other members of the board about that and be back in touch with you. Did I make directions as to the timing for presentation of material, preparation of material for the 5th of December? I think I indicated when the council's material to be ready, I think, by the end of next week, wasn't it?
Yes, we've talked about those dates. I don't think directions have been made.
Well, is there any advance on what I indicated, which I think was essentially the council's material could be filed and served by the 17th or earlier if possible, and then the responses by the 24th of November if possible. And then we've got a bit of time prior to the 5th for us to consider that in some detail and see if anything else may be needed.
Yes.
Any issue with that, any part? I think Mr. Roberts wants to say something.
Sorry, sir, I think you're missing a step there, in that, as I understood it, it was the council's track changes by the 17th, the parties closes on the 24th, and then the council.
Oh, yes, sorry. Thank you very much.
So that was the only.
Yes, no, you're quite right. And then the council's material or response, giving you effectively a reply, Mr. Conway, Mr. Fisher, no later than the 1st of December. And I think we're still waiting for the further information about fencing costs and so on, aren't we?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And I have inquired and asked if that can be provided by the end of this week. I'm conscious it may assist us.
Tomorrow.
At the end of this week.
Yeah.
But there's a proviso on that because I understand some of the witnesses are still wanting more information. So I've asked for a version that will answer the questions to the best of their ability tomorrow, and if they can identify in it what further information they would seek in order to be more certain. And then, obviously, if there are any directions that followed that about whether that was of assistance to the court, I'd be grateful to understand that. But
you know what I'm going to say about certainty, don't you?
Certainly do.
Yes. And so you can tell those witnesses that pursuing this to the point of extracting quotes from fencing contractors that Commissioner Hodges can rely on for the next 6 months is not what we're looking for.
I don't think that would come as a surprise to them, but I think there's still some desire to have that certainty by some. But I understand and I convey the sentiment you've outlined.
Thank you. Very good.
Sir, just on that, so the all that the Director General's witnesses are waiting on is some calculations or the workings of the calculations for fencing costs, so they can comment on that. I understand that's coming through today from Dr. Lemire. And in terms of the mapping issues, they just got together yesterday to discuss that, and our experts are working on that as well.
None of these deadlines necessarily drop dead matters. If we could, a bit more time is needed for a reasonable degree of certainty to provide it.
Thank you, sir.
Sir, if I heard you correctly, that the court is working on the site visit arrangements rather than waiting to hear from the parties. I had indicated to my friends that, in light of the indication from Your Honour yesterday morning, White Ivy no longer feels a need for the court to visit that site.
Well, it is an update in terms of that. I just need to look at the list. And I think that, and thank you for that indication. Realistically, getting into the depths of the upper catchment is much more difficult than, for example, looking at some of the areas from a marina wetland, say a farm like Lockyer, what we need to see. But if there are advances in terms of what was outlined in Mr. Matheson's memorandum to us, then if you provide that just by email to the registrar, we'd be grateful.
Yes, so just on that, with the sites that the Director General suggested, and we're just working on a map just to help the board with
that. That would be helpful.
There's also the offer from the Director General for any dock rangers to assist with transport.
Well, that will depend very much on the locations you identify in the map.
Yes, yes.
And what the likely ability for us to access them. We generally prefer to get where we need to go on our own, but appreciate there'll be circumstances here where it would be extremely desirable to have the assistance of a ranger or somebody who's able to keep us safe.
Yes, sir, and we'll just need some dates and then that's available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one final intervention related matter, sir, and I hesitate to raise it. On the basis that Ms. Wilson's statement is going to be accepted in some capacity, some point.
Well, it is.
Yes. She reminded me that there was one correction she was intending to make.
If you would send that through to us so that we've got a careful record of it, would be great.
Well, what your requirement or anyone, just an email.
An email would be sufficient.
And it's just there was a just for clarification, there was a reference to an additional affidavit that ultimately didn't get produced, and there's just an email.
Well, then it may be desirable for her to confer with you and for you to provide an email. Copy, and as long as you get it to the registrar, she can make sure it's copied to everybody on our email.
I'll get it.
Thank you very much.
But being provided with the emails.
Nothing further? Right, very good. Thank you all very much for your participation. We'll see you on the 5th. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one.